to order. And we're going to get started. I want to thank everybody for coming today. We're going to be hearing from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and Commissioner Bartholomew. We'll be welcoming momentarily. And I just want to say we're really happy. We're going to be looking at the 2010-2011 Affordable Housing Plan. And this is an opportunity for us to hear the latest on what the commissioner and the agency is planning to do, and also a chance for us to weigh in on this before it goes to the board, the MHFA board, if there are thoughts that people want to share. And I'm happy to be co-chairing this with Senator Kielash. Would you like
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the comments, and I'm looking forward to the presentation, and hopefully this is a start for getting into the next session, and also, you know, the sessions after that where the budgets look tight. So hopefully we can get some good information from all the parties here. Thank you.
Great. And there will be an opportunity for some public comment if that's desired. So, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. I believe members all have a memorandum that came out earlier from MHFA. I hope you had a chance to look at that. Welcome.
Maybe some materials that have been passed around.
Yes, I believe so.
Well, House and Senate committee members, it's my pleasure to be here before you today and have the opportunity to share with you the highlights of our agency's 2010-2011 Affordable Housing Plan, which describes the agency's framework and funding priorities for the budget program budget for the 2010-2011 biennium. First, I want to thank the House and the Senate and you as Housing Committee members for your efforts to support affordable housing in the last session and in other sessions as well. Minnesota Housing takes the process of developing its two-year program budget very seriously. And I'm very proud of the plan that we have in front of you. And the tremendous amount of work that went into it. I believe it reflects the broad responsibility that our agency holds to serve a full continuum of affordable housing needs across the entire state of Minnesota. In developing this plan, we had to contend with a deep recession, a housing credit crisis, and a changing finance industry landscape. The summary memo that many of you received or should have received last week outlined some of the key trends that we considered in our deliberations when we came up with the plan. The creation of the Affordable Housing Plan is an agency-wide effort, and Tanya Orr, our Assistant Commissioner for Policy, and Patricia Hippie, our Deputy Commissioner, played a vital role in the process. And Tanya, our in-house expert, would like to be here today but can't because she's in traveling in Europe and therefore is unable to join us. But Jeanette Blankenship, one of our key policy division members, is here to help me today. So let me start by just saying a little bit of outcomes for the meeting today or my presentation today. It is my hope that we will walk away with a better understanding of four main areas. First of all is the agency's role in creating and preserving affordable housing and the logic behind our affordable housing plan. Also, we hope to better understand the continuum of the housing needs that we fund and the impact of our funding has on the field and on communities across the state. And also the critical role that state appropriations play and the ability that this gives us, in other words, the appropriations dollar for the agencies to reach Minnesota's most needy populations. And lastly, to better understand the way the agency takes a thoughtful and strategic approach and leadership in the housing field and our nation-leading model for financing affordable housing overall. To accomplish this, I will walk you through some of the plan elements, its sources and uses, and explain how the pieces of the program budget fit together and how the agency resources are used to complement other sources of funding. The first slide three that you have, I believe, in front of you was just what I just mentioned, and then to slide four talks about missions and strategic priorities. The mission of the agency is to finance and advance affordable housing opportunities for low and moderate income Minnesotans to enhance the quality of life and foster strong communities. In this respect, we both serve the people of Minnesota and the communities. We are equally focused on people and communities. This is the mission that drives all the work the agency does. Our priorities include five areas: financing new housing, affordable housing opportunities, preserve existing affordable housing, ending long-term homelessness, increasing emerging market homeownership, and addressing the foreclosure crisis both through recovery and prevention. I'll be going into more detail on what this means later in my presentation. But just for a moment, I wanted to share a little bit more about Minnesota Housing. Slide 5 talks about the Board of Directors. Minnesota Housing is one of 4 state agencies governed by an independent Board of Directors. This is important because the Board is vested with the authority to set the policies and priorities for the agency. The management and control of the agency is vested solely in the members of the Board by statute, and the Board includes 6 citizens appointed by the Governor, no more than 3 from the metropolitan area, and no more than 1 from any one of the economic development regions outside of the metro area. And we also include the state auditor as an ex officio member. Our board, as it consists today, it represents interests from a broad cross-section of the state and is populated well by well-informed and experienced individuals from the banking, foundation, and construction sectors, along with the state auditor, Rebecca Otto. And as a policymaking body, their role is to make sure that Minnesota Housing as an agency remains true to its mission, that we are good stewards of the funding resources that we have, and to hold us accountable for achieving our goals that we set out to achieve. Our chair, Mike Finch, has been involved with Minnesota Housing for almost 30 years. As a result, he brings the experience, integrity, and continuity to this position to help focus the agency on continuous improvement, which is an overarching goal for all that we do in the agency. It's the board's responsibility ultimately to set the parameters and priorities for the work that we do, and they will be voting on the affordable housing plan, I believe, Thursday of this week. We overall, as a state agency, have one of the strongest records for serving lower income households anywhere in the country. I want to point you to slide 6, which is the highlights of Minnesota Housing Assistance from last year, 2008. In 2008, Minnesota Housing assisted more than 67,000 households and spent over just about $700 million to have that impact. We served nearly 46,000 rental units and tenant households with funding of around $260 million. We also served 21,000 home buyers or homeowners with a little under $410 million in financing, and then we provided more than $1 million in organizational support, technical assistance, and capacity building to help build capacity within the field. We also worked to finance the purchase of nearly 2,800 units of existing homes and the construction of nearly 800 new housing units. We were involved in preserving nearly 5,700 units of existing affordable housing. And in regards to ending long-term homelessness, we assisted about 11,000 households or units with supportive housing through both capital investments and assistance through vouchers. Now, if we could go to slide 7, we'll talk a little bit about the affordable housing plan overview. As I mentioned earlier, developing the affordable housing plan is a painstaking process that involves assessing the current environment, the context within which we're working, gathering input from our partners and stakeholders, and developing allocation guidelines, which we use as a way to monitor whether or not we're thinking clearly about how we're setting our goals. And all of that is focused on achieving our 5 strategic priorities. Overall, the upcoming 2010-11 Affordable Housing Plan, which we also call our program budget, totals more than $1.4 billion for the next biennium. It's estimated that we will serve around 97,000 Minnesota households and under this plan, and I am proud to present this budget, which I do believe addresses fairly the continuum of housing needs in Minnesota. The budget allocations balance the need to respond to the current issues of foreclosure and the stalled tax credit projects with maintaining the momentum that we've had on longstanding issues and priorities, including homelessness, preservation, and creating new affordable housing opportunities. The plan responds well to what we heard as priorities from our partners, stakeholders, and the communities that we serve. We heard from others that we should increase our focus on foreclosure, that we should spend more of our time and energy on preservation and consider other ways to provide more flexibility for communities to address their housing needs as they see fit. We've balanced the short-term focus on foreclosure and homelessness with the long-term interests of the state by allocating our agency resources to the maximum extent possible without diminishing our ability to provide a strong and stable source of funding for years to come. We've made a strong effort to leverage federal resources to the greatest extent possible and to encourage job creation and housing opportunities in the short term, given the economic conditions. Given the significant inflow of the federal ARRA funds, which are the stimulus package funding, and this is the main source of increased funding for the budget this year, these funds focus primarily on keeping tax credit developments in the pipeline moving forward. We've been able to fund some critical priorities, as I mentioned, foreclosure, homelessness, and preservation activities with other funding sources. We're also committed in all that we do to focus both on achieving our housing goals, in other words, serving the people with units and housing units, but also maximizing the positive community impact of our housing investments. We know that housing investment can spur community development activity as well, and we're focused on that. In all that we do, we remain focused on sustainability and innovation as cornerstone values that we will promote in everything that we do as an agency. Now to slide 8, which outlines the larger categories of resources available in the plan. If you look at this pie chart, the pie chart provides a high-level summary of funding sources and what was included in your memo for reference. So many of you have already maybe had a chance to look at this. It's also included in the package here today. As you can see, the bond proceeds and federal resources account for more than $1 billion of the total $1.4 billion plan. Of the bond proceeds, about $618 million bond proceeds are used primarily for two purposes. The first and primary purpose, which accounts for about $550 million of the bonds, is for first mortgage financing that we use to help first-time homebuyers get into home ownership opportunities. The second major component of the bond proceeds is used at $68 million for rental production activities. Of the $462 million, which is the federal resources allocated on the pie chart, the bulk of that is used, $310 million, for Section 8 rental subsidies. In other words, there's Section 8 funds from the federal government that flow through to families and projects to write down the costs of the housing through rental assistance. $75 million of the federal funds is through tax credits that are allocated to projects in the pipeline, and $28 million supports homeownership activities. Now, these sources, the federal sources and the bonding sources, represent a large share of the overall budget, and both of those sources have very little flexibility. In other words, they have to be used primarily for the designated purposes that they were set out to provide. The remaining $321 million that remains in the chart consists of agency resources and state appropriations. So for now, I want to draw your attention to the state appropriations. If you look at the state appropriations, the base appropriation agency budget for the years 2010-2011 is $868,768,000. On your chart, however, it shows about $111 million. I wanted to point out what the discrepancy is there. The difference is because of revolving loan funds that exist out in the community. We actually calculate that number and count that towards the appropriation money, although it's recycling out there in the community. And it also includes some carry-forward amounts from the previous biennium. I also wanted to just tell you and explain how critical a role state appropriations play as a resource for serving the most difficult and needy populations in our state. First of all, the primary beneficiaries, or many of the beneficiaries of the appropriated funds, include families who are in shelters by getting them temporary housing assistance through the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program. We also serve first-time home buyers at lower incomes of the spectrum by providing down payment assistance through the Homeownership Assistance Fund. And long-term homeless are served through this by providing more supportive housing and temporary rental assistance through the Housing Trust Fund. We also enable and support low-income homeowners who are able to remain in their homes by allowing them to get reasonable priced rehab loan programs, and these serve many of the lowest income homeowners. And then communities as a whole prosper from your sources that are unable, we support communities who are unable to respond effectively to local conditions through the flexible funds that we provide through the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, which is actually the agency's most flexible source of funding for community housing work. If you look at the slides 9 and 10, these are two slides, one that focuses on multifamily and the other one that focuses on single family, and shows the important role that state appropriations play. The state appropriations are important in allowing us to provide a mission-focused services to Minnesotans with low incomes. State appropriated assistance in the multifamily area on the top slide, or slide 9, serves median incomes at half of what we are able to do with our core agency assistance. In the single family arena, we can assist homeowners who have very low incomes with rehabilitation needs, enable them to, more low-income Minnesotans to become homeowners with down payment assistance that's provided by the state appropriations. So if you look at these two charts, it becomes very clear that the state appropriations really do allow us to serve the most needy and most difficult to serve populations in Minnesota. Now, if I turn your attention to agency resources, which is the final piece on the pie chart, approximately $211 million, of which $158 million must provide a return on investments, is in that pie chart, and $52 million that can be used for deferred loans and grants to help fill gaps to address our strategic priorities. These resources and the resources, some of the home fund resources, which are federal resources that have some flexibility in their use, actually create what we call, in this chart to the right hand on slide 9, the discretionary funds, which is a term we came up with to be able to explain that these are funds that are not pre-designated by statute or by authority, but we have some discretionary power over allocating within our budget. They total 12.5% of the total budget that can be directed by the agency, and $174 million is available over our OVIS amount. $141 million is the agency resources, and $33 million represents the home funds. What's important here as we look at this chart is to think about these relative to the priorities that we've set. So these two charts look at how we're going to spend our money relative to our set of 5 strategic priorities. And so as we look through this, I'm going to share with you a little bit more about those strategic priorities. So in the chart to the left, you'll see the overall commitment in this plan for financing new affordable housing opportunities is 46% of the overall investment. But if you look at the discretionary resources, that amount drops to 23% of what we had control over in our budget. And when we talk about financing new affordable housing opportunities, we're referring to all the activities that create housing opportunities. This includes first mortgage programs, down payment assistance programs that help low and moderate income people become homeowners. It includes our rental housing programs to build new units of affordable housing. It also includes efforts to rehabilitate and preserve existing apartment buildings that are not currently affordable, to turn them into quality rental housing opportunities for the long run, and rental assistance payments that open up new rental opportunities for extremely low-income renters. Our goal to increase emerging market homeownership among the emerging markets is a subsection of our financing new opportunities. It's actually a sub-goal within that. It's a priority that falls within that category. We know that emerging market communities are growing and are an important part of our first-time home buyer market overall. They're the fastest growing portion of the first-time home buyer market in Minnesota. And I wanted to point out that despite the recession, one bright spot in the last year was that we had hoped to continue our success in the future year with emerging market loans is that after establishing a stretch goal of 17.5% last year, we were hoping to meet have all of our loans go, 17.5% of all of our loans go towards emerging markets. We expect by year end to have 30% of all of our current mortgage loans go to serve that emerging market. So we're actually exceeding that goal in the short term. There's lots of reasons for that. Part of it's the down economy, but we're hoping to actually exceed that goal. I also wanted to point out that one of our key partners that serves single family needs and home ownership issues across the state, Habitat for Humanity, 78% of all the units they provide actually serve emerging market homeowners. So creating new affordable housing opportunities is really a core part of what we do and a part of our mission that we continue to do over the long term. When we look at preserving existing affordable housing, the overall allocation is 46%, but if you look at our discretionary sources, it's the equivalent of 54% of our overall allocation of discretionary resources. And by preserving existing affordable housing, we're referring to assisting the preservation and maintenance of affordable housing that already exists. Our efforts to preserve Section 8 certificates provided by the federal government in projects is a part of this work, as well as efforts to prevent existing affordable housing projects from converting to market rate housing that would turn them into market rate housing and take them out of the affordable stock. We have a lot of work to do with preservation as a whole. We know, however, that preserving housing units is far more cost effective than building new units, so we dedicate a significant capital resources toward preservation activities. And in this plan, it's a higher priority than new housing units is overall. We're still very committed to ending long-term homelessness, and in this plan, we dedicate 5% of the overall resources and 6% of our discretionary resources towards that goal. It has been a top priority for the last 5 years, and this is because it serves perhaps the most vulnerable population that needs housing and the group that has been underserved within the broader housing field for years. The homeless population really over a long period of time has been underserved as a subset of our overall population. By focusing attention on this goal for the last several years and working with other state departments and sectors, we've made significant strides toward achieving our goal of creating 4,000 supportive housing units to serve this needy population. So far, we've created almost 2,500 units of supportive housing to help long-term homelessness. And since 2004, we committed and spent $50 million of agency resources towards that goal. In this affordable housing plan, we're adding $7.5 million to that $50 million goal, an additional $7.5 million to this commitment to maintain the momentum of the effort and to make sure that the projects we've already financed remain sustainable for the long run. We remain committed to this long-term homelessness goal, but we'll go through an effort of recalibrating our plan based on the outcome of the Wilder survey that's going to be coming up. They're going to be starting the Wilder Homeless Survey in October, and hopefully they'll have the results sometime in February. And as we look at how we move forward with this goal, we'll recalibrate it based on what they find in their survey results. And last but not least, addressing foreclosure through recovery and prevention has overall allocation of 3%. And of our discretionary resources, 17%. And that's an important point because we know that foreclosure is a very important issue, and we're well aware of the challenge ahead of us. It's a very complex issue and very large in scale, so the agency has to be very careful about how to target its resources for the greatest impact. So through partnerships with nonprofits, we've invested $13.1 million in foreclosure counseling and prevention efforts over the last couple of years to build a network of agencies that are serving to counsel and help people avoid foreclosure. In that period, over the last year, we've helped over 15,000 people through that program, and I think about 40% of them were successfully avoided the foreclosure overall. We're also responsible for allocating $38.8 million in federal neighborhood stabilization program funds. I just want to point out that those funds are not included in these numbers, because these numbers in this budget are as new activities. So what we have remaining in the foreclosure money is about $30 million that has not been spent. It's been committed to various cities and organizations across the state, but it's still being spent. We're right in the process of allocating those funds and working through the foreclosure issues in neighborhoods and communities across the state. We're also committing an additional $30 million in agency resources to address this problem, which is in that number through this budget. But when you add the $30 million of federal funds committed but not spent and the $30 million in agency resources, plus, I want to point out, a priority through the Housing and Economic Development Challenge Program, which is going to have a priority for foreclosure-related activities. We'll spend well over $70 million on foreclosure over the next two-year period. We still have many needs to stabilize communities, and the foreclosure challenge could draw more and more resources. And that's one of the reasons why we have in our bonding request, which is also not a part of this affordable housing plan, a request for $27.5 million to acquire foreclosed rental properties or to build supportive housing. That those funds are being asked to have some flexibility to be able to respond to the issues at hand and to respond to proposals that come in to use those funds. And we're also setting aside in that bonding budget $2.5 million for land trusts so they can acquire properties in areas impacted by foreclosure. So overall, if we do our job well and strategically focus our resources, we'll be able to address all of the five priorities and succeed in addressing what we believe to be a really important continuum of affordable housing across the state. Lastly, I wanted to point your attention to slide 12 and talk a little bit about how our money is spent across the state. We're not only committed to addressing the continuum of housing needs, but we're also committed to serving the housing needs of communities across the state. And we have strong partnerships in every region of our state to respond to housing needs. For example, when job growth was increasing rapidly in Southwest, we worked with partners to increase the supply of rental housing and just recently completed a rental townhome development in Worthington. And as the IRH prepares for an influx of jobs, we have been working with the partnership in the Northeast to assist with providing financing for the housing needs identified through a market study. As you can look at this map, although we do not have a set targets for the distribution of our resources in the metro area and greater Minnesota, as you can see by the map and the table that's adjoining to it, the share of assisted households, the share of eligible households, and the share of our funds contributed to each area are closely aligned with the need in those districts. Again, we are pleased to be able to share the highlights of the agency's budget with you here today. I believe that Minnesota Housing has done a good job of balancing its investments to address short-term issues with long-term positioning the agency to provide consistent leadership and funding sources into the future so we can maintain some ongoing kind of consistent support for affordable housing across the state. And I hope you can see through this plan that we are an affordable housing catalyst that provides nonpartisan, balanced leadership with the interests of the public in Minnesota in mind. Our focus is really on outcomes for people and communities. So I want to thank you again for your continued interest and support for affordable housing. We know that the people that are served by your investments are critically benefit from your resource investments in affordable housing. And now I'd like to open it up for any questions you might have.
Senator Diddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this report and helping us understand how we're going to prioritize our resources going forward. I was wondering, though, as I was listening, I was reflecting on another committee I serve, which is the Transportation Committee. The Department of Transportation, as well as the Metropolitan Council, have done for the past several years, and we just heard a story come out in the past month or so, kind of identifying the big picture, the overall need, doing a fairly accurate analysis of that. And, of course, the big news was over the coming decade or so, we have about a $50 billion shortfall in addressing the transportation need, which is a pretty widely accepted, fairly objective and dispassionate analysis. So can you help us understand, do we have a picture of the need, the overall need for preservation, for building new, for affordable, for all the continuum of housing issues that are out there? The reason I ask is because there was an NPR report that we heard a couple days ago. I think it was Brown Dan Brown, I think. Anyways, he's the author. Anyways, Dan Olson, telling us that we need something like 33,000 units of affordable housing by the end of the decade. I'm wondering if that's a figure that we accept and if we're going to get there and how we know what the overall need is and how close this gets us to that.
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, we know that affordability overall is decreasing because of the cost of housing versus the wages going up. So that number is kind of a moving target. That being said, we are right now in the process of doing community profiles, which we're trying to look at real specific numbers across the state that would identify on a series of characteristics what the need within certain areas would be relative to the population that's there and the amount of money that individuals make in those communities and relative to the housing price. So our plan, you know, will not address the entire need, and nor have we ever really been able to do that. I think the best we can do with our plan is to try to fill as much of a gap as we can. I do believe that as a field, we need to be thinking more about how the private sector is involved in this. We have private sector developers involved in affordable housing, but whether or not we have affordable housing embedded in all the housing projects that get developed in our communities, you know, some communities have fairly strong goals for what they call inclusionary housing, which allows them to get percentages of housing affordable. St. Paul is a good example of that. Whether that actually meets the larger housing need over time, I think is still a big question mark.
I'm sure.
Senator Dibble.
If I could just follow up. And, that would be, I mean, this all sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. And it's impressive, and the way the priorities are right. I'll be interested in hearing from the public about whether or not these priorities and this allocation of funds make sense. But it's really hard to make a rational decision to know, as a legislator, if this is enough money or too much. So to the extent that you continue to work on that, helping us identify what the needs, understanding that the money we put in leverages other dollars, we don't need to take care of the sum total through state appropriations or appropriating our federal allocation just perfectly, but we really do need a handle on what is the picture, so we can make some sort of, what does $1 billion mean relative to the need out there? I have more questions, but I'll wait. And also, if I could put that question to folks who are going to come forward and testify, help us understand the context and the scale and the scope of the challenges that we confront so that we can think rationally about $500 million or $1 billion.
I want to just make one comment relative to the whole budget, and I think it's important. One of the reasons I pointed out the $1 billion of funds up front that were federal and bond, those bond funds are used to support ownership opportunities. And just to be clear, those bonds allow us to earn some revenue that then we turn around and plow back into the most difficult housing needs. So it's important that $550 million of this that really goes towards first-time home buyer mortgages, which is not necessarily available for the most difficult population, nor is it used in primary purpose for rental housing. And I think there is a lot of room to work on more rental housing. I think we could use to do more rental housing overall.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, Commissioner Bartholomew, thank you for the report. I think it is it's comprehensive, and thank your staff for doing a good job. I just had a couple of questions, starting with the issue of supportive housing and homelessness. I noted that you said that you had allocated funds to create more supportive housing. And I guess my question is, as I know supportive housing, we can potentially build it, we can get capital funds, you can help with the operating funds, but what makes it supportive is the services. And it has come to my attention, and I've worked in this field for a while, that that's where we're really missing the money. And that doesn't necessarily always come under your purview per se or either under the agency, but can you comment on where the service dollars are coming from, or is there been a change either at the Department of Human Service or even federally at HHS that allows us to kind of close the gap in terms of the services that we need to provide the services if we build supportive housing.
Commissioner?
Sure. The service dollars are really the difficult Achilles heel of the overall plan. And we've done a good job of being able to get the service dollars for projects to date. Future projects, we're going to have to be, you know, working to get that either through the private sector, through the Heading Home effort, or perhaps the federal government, which is beginning to take notice of this priority. I think we feel that it's worth at least trying to continue with this, acknowledging that this plan, although it is our plan for the next 2 years, has some flexibility in it. If we find that that's not going to be feasible, we could potentially reallocate that. But we don't want to do that until we've done the fairly detailed analysis, the recalibration, as we call it, to make sure that we learn from what we've done in the past and identify how we would be able to achieve the 4,000 units over a longer period of time. We're not pretending to think that we can do that in the short term, but we also think it's still a reasonably strong and valuable goal to focus over a period of time on addressing those needs. There may be some other ways, ultimately, we have to think about that other than the traditional service approach, but I don't have a specific funding source for you today.
Ms.
Underhaid.
And then just on another note, you talked about the amount of money and time that you spent in foreclosure prevention. I think all of us, the whole world has become aware of all of the foreclosure issues that we have. I know of a plan that I became aware of, the Metropolitan Land Bank, that talked about being able to put together a plan to acquire units and rehab them and sell them at a market rate, and hopefully that plan, and this is loose, helps to stabilize communities and protect them. Can you talk about the agency's participation in that plan or what you know of it and how that works in your overall goal of, you know, foreclosure prevention, or even on the backside of that, once a home has been foreclosed, preserving neighborhoods and communities?
Sure. I mean, the agency has committed $10 million in loan funds towards the land bank as a whole, which is really a centralized approach to working with a variety of developers who then ultimately will turn that around and turn it into housing that's available either for market or rental. Going forward, we have in our plan some commitments to work on foreclosure. I believe, Jeanette, I might have to throw in another $10 million that's possible to be committed to that, pending an analysis of that fund and its ability to do that. I think the key to that fund is that it provides, and our money is all loan money, so it's all dedicated to get a return of at least 5% on that investment, and then it's used for interim financing, which is really construction financing that will allow folks that are in the process of trying to rehab and rehabilitate these buildings to have interim money to make that happen, so that then when they get done, that money gets paid back to that fund and recycles again. So that's how that works from our perspective. And Jeanette, if you have anything else you want to offer to that. Okay.
And then, Madam Chair, so you did say that would be home ownership and rental housing. I guess my concern is that we have a segment of our population that have been foreclosed, and we have seen those folks show up either they're doubled up or they're in a shelter or precariously housed. And so I wanted to understand, and I don't want to push you too much on the land bank because it's something that you're participating in, not something that you're responsible for, but what our strategy is as it relates to getting those folks housed that have been pushed out because of the foreclosure crisis.
On the rental or the home ownership, or both? You just...
Well, I'm thinking about the rental. I mean, I think a lot of the folks that have been foreclosed on are not going to be in the position to have home ownership opportunities anytime soon, is what my thought would be.
We have a priority for both. And I think the challenge that we have as a state agency is that, to some degree, we're dependent on the capacity of our partners, local partners, to be able to turn, you know, work with owners on rental housing. So we're committed. We'd love to do more foreclosed rental things in the scheme of both our NSP money and others. But we're dependent on how well our development partners and our local cities are able to gain control of those and work with those projects. We're not the, quote, doers, per se. We're the investors. And so we're open and welcome that possibility, and we're really trying to push, actually, through our NSP to do more of that as quickly as possible. I think the rental ones tend to be a little more complicated, and as a result, they're harder to get going quickly. And so far, I think the single family have been more at the forefront of what's happening in the impacted areas. But I don't know, Jeanette, you may have some comments on the rental piece.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jeanette Blankenship with Minnesota Housing. Representative Hayden, regarding rental, Commissioner Bartholomew did mention that as part of our capital bonding request, $27.5 million is for to acquire foreclosed rental properties or supportive housing, or to construct or rehab supportive housing. So we really see that as a vital piece of tool capital that can also help, and those would have to remain affordable for the length of the debt service on those bonds, which would be 20 years. So we see that as another source of capital to allow us to serve the affordable rental needs in communities that have been impacted by foreclosure.
If you could, as long as you're here today, just ask a little bit more on that particular question. Last year we had some discussion about whether the bonding dollars could be used for those properties that were housing trusts, land trusts. Can you talk a little bit more about where that's come in development? Because I think it's changed a bit, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, our council did look at the issue of how could we use bond proceeds to help land trusts acquire land, and did review the law and decided and made a decision that an interpretation that the land trust could use it to acquire land, but not the property, since the structure. The land can be owned by the nonprofit, and the structure is what's owned by the person on the community land trust. And so as we're able to structure that legally, we can use bond proceeds, which is why we have $2.5 million as part of our capital request for community land trusts. And that's to acquire properties in areas impacted by foreclosure with a priority along transit corridors, because we recognize those are especially areas that we want to preserve affordable housing.
And Ms. Langbridge, in terms of transit corridors, how do you define that?
I believe it's, Madam Chair, within currently under our challenge program, we also have a priority. It's within a half mile of a light rail or a bus rapid transit. And there is an allowance for frequent metro transit.
Excuse me, the last part was frequent metro transit?
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit more, please?
Frequency, I think, is every 15 minutes.
If there's a bus coming by or a train coming by. Okay. Thank you. Other questions, comments? I had a couple of questions. In terms of your foreclosure, I think you mentioned that 40% of the, Commissioner, you mentioned that 40% of the counseling services through HECAT were effective in helping people, be able to turn the situation around. Can you say a little bit more about that and what kind of period of time we're talking about? Was it, I mean, one of the problems and one of the challenges, of course, is if there is an opportunity to use some federal funds or other, or if the person, comes into the ability to, deal with whatever the crisis was that caused them to go into foreclosure, it may be temporary, maybe a very short period of time. What kind of sustainability is there, I guess, in that 40%? Are we talking about people who are able to continue for a while or just briefly? I'm curious how we're doing with that.
Jeanette, would you have asked that? That's a tough question because the things change so fast for people, and now the foreclosure are really happening largely based on job loss, and before they were based on the financing system. So that's, I think, a very difficult question to answer. I'm not sure I can answer it.
Is there? Do you have any recommendations on how to address that? Or I'm just wondering, are any of the federal stimulus funds now being effectively used in that? I know it was for the there was a lot of frustration for a period of time with how those were not being available, or I don't know, either one.
Well,
of them.
I mean, I think it's clear that the restructuring and modifications are not happening at a rate that anybody had hoped or anticipated they would. And I don't have the statistics, but I know that that's not happening the way that it was anticipated in the marketplace. And I would say, as a result, you're not having the outcomes that you would have hoped to have had. One of the things we're trying to sort of is there anything beyond what we normally do that we would be able to do? We don't have any, magic wands or anything, but one of the things we have in the plan is this issue. Are there to start to think about whether there are anything different than what we've already done that a state agency could do? I mean, we're not, know, in the scheme of the whole marketplace out there, we're really a relatively small, modest piece, and we can only have so much ability to influence those larger systems. Nevertheless, I think it's important for us to be thinking that way. I'm not sure that that's very helpful to you right now, but there is no really good answers to those questions.
Madam Chair, just to add on to what Commissioner Bartholomew said, between the federal resources, which is about $10 million plus another $3 million of agency resources, we put that $13 million out for foreclosure prevention counseling in addition to the HECAP funding. And the federal money is tracked through the NeighborWorks program. And they issued a report maybe 6 months ago that summarized what the outcomes were as far as, you know, who was being counseled, what was happening. But I haven't seen anything recently, so I'd be happy to check up on that and see if there's an update on those outcomes.
So in terms of any creative ideas, you're not really, you don't have something in mind right now that you would like legislators or others to think about in terms of the foreclosure crisis, anything that you've come up with in the interim? Or you're talking about the bonding, I think, and that's about...
Well, I think the challenge with the prevention is that you have to get involved much earlier, and it really means that it's something more related to the banking industry than it is related to our money, per se. I don't know how to say that, but the point is, in our just deliberation, we realized we can only do so much on foreclosure from where we sit, and that there's a structural thing that we don't as an entity have control over that really needs to get earlier in the pipeline, which might relate to the rules and regulations in the banking industry, which we don't have any, you know, real control over. We have yet to really talk about what we would or wouldn't have in that realm, but we realize that getting earlier in the pipeline, somehow before people ever get to that point where they're even having to be counseled on foreclosure, until we get there, the chances are this is going to continue to happen.
Well, Commissioner, I just want to say, though, I mean, legislators here, we serve on different committees, and we'd be interested in any kind of recommendations that you know, on the ground would have in terms of those other agencies, you know, in terms of regulation, either and relationships with the federal government. I mean, we can do some lobbying with our colleagues at the federal level as well, you know, I'm sure the agency too, and I'm just wondering if you have a plan or recommendations for us.
We don't have a plan, but it's on our list to think a little bit about whether there are things, and we put together the affordable housing plan to do it in a time frame. It doesn't necessarily allow you to do the kind of research you might want to do on some emerging ideas, you know, that might, so we don't have anything to offer to you now, but as we think about this, we'd certainly provide you with that information.
Okay. Representative Hayden.
Thank you. I just have one more just kind of question, or if you guys can help me. I think that often the foreclosure crisis, I've heard it talk about in three different veins. It's either the really tough predatory loans that people shouldn't have even gotten underwritten, if you will, the ARMs and exploding balloon payments and reset, the economic downturn, even if you're in a good loan, you just lost your job and you can't pay for it, and I forgot what the third was, but can you help us understand at least the mortgages that come from the agency? What are you seeing in terms of defaults there? Are they higher? Are they lower? Are they the national average? Because you didn't give out the predatory loans, if you will. The individuals have to go through quite a process in order to receive that. So can you speak just a little bit to that?
Let me start, and then I'll have to pass it over to Jeanette, if that's okay. Our rates are much lower than the market as a whole. And the big difference, I think, is that all of our loan participants, folks that get loans through our product, are required to have home ownership counseling. And we know that not everybody should be necessarily owning a home. I mean, it's just a fact. And so we've had a far fewer problems with our loans, although we are, with the unemployment rising, I think that's where we're starting to get, you know, an uptick in our numbers is based on not on people's ability, you know, the underwriting that was done originally, but it's more on the job market. I think Jeanette might have a little bit more information for you.
Ms. Blankenberg?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the most recent data I have in front of me shows, for if we compare our loans to benchmark loans, which are also prime loans because we have a fixed rate. We don't do adjustable rate loans, for example. The benchmark from the Bankers Association of Minnesota was 0.96 of those prime loans are in foreclosure, and ours is 0.79%. So we are below that benchmark.
Thank you. Senator Kulesh?
Yes, we've been talking about how you're trying to leverage funds and that. I'm just kind of looking for kind of a history of where the last year has been and projecting into the future. If we're because the credit markets are so tight and it seems like it's hard for just about any construction project to get funding, I'm wondering if we're increasing, if the agency is increasing its percentage of contributions to projects, number one, and if that matching has dropped off significantly in the past year, and what you're looking for in the next 2 years with this plan as far as whether or not there'll be more demand for it, or if there's going to be less projects but more of agency dollars invested in it. I don't know if I made myself clear.
Well, I think, this past year has been, unprecedented both across the board in terms of the single family, our ability to do single family lending, because the bond markets were turned upside down. We were unable to do nearly as many loans as we did the year before. The projection that we have for the next period of doing 550 in single family mortgages, I believe, is about over 200 million more than what we did this last year. And mm-hmm. So we're assuming things are going to get better, and in fact, our rates have come down now. We're actually competitive with the market now. So that's good news. Mm-hmm. On the multifamily side, the stimulus package money, the ARRA monies, there were two pieces of that have helped us be able to begin to accelerate the pipeline of projects that were already kind of underwritten to begin with and looked at. There's an exchange program which allows folks who we've allocated credits to return their credits to us and for us to turn them into the Treasury for cash, 80 cents on a dollar, which means we're going to be able to move some of those projects forward. And then in addition, there's a thing called the Tax Credit Assistance Program, which is a HUD program that also is allocating additional gap financing funds that can fill a gap between what the market will pay for tax credits, meaning the syndicators who buy credits that end up creating the equity that goes into the projects can pay a little less for those credits, and the federal government will fill the gap for that project. So the upshot is that we just recently approved 16 projects to move forward. Was it last month? Or a month and a half ago, last month, that are now being re-underwritten, and we expect to have actually a couple of closings before the end of October. So there's some uptick going in those projects. We actually expect 16 projects to go to be done in the next year, whereas this last year, I don't know, were there any? Maybe one or two projects that actually concluded that were started earlier last year. So those tools are helping us to be able to kind of accelerate those projects again.
And then just in terms, just in terms of the percentage of investment required by the agency to make those project goals as compared to past performance, my thought is that with the credit market so tight and money less available from private sector, is it forcing us, in order to get the project built, to increase our investment in these projects?
In the short term, because of the ARRA funding, I'm thinking it's going to be relatively similar. In the long term, when those funds dry up, it'll be a very different scenario again, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 18 months from now or so. So in the short term, I would say the answer is no. In the long term, it's going to be a big question.
Thank you. Senator
Marty? Madam Chair, Commissioner, a couple of smaller points and then a bigger question. First of all, in terms of seniors in affordable housing, I told the need is growing fast. The projections are that it's growing faster than the population at large. Is the agency thinking of doing anything in particular to address shortage of senior housing, affordable housing for seniors?
Well, we are well aware of the overall growing senior population. We do serve some seniors now. We have not created an additional focus in the short term on that. I think we realize that the resources that we have in the short term and the needs that we have for the things that we're already doing and trying to do some things well, we've chosen in this plan to focus on foreclosure and preservation. Although preservation, a good portion of that will be senior, and we know that one of the things, there's some new studies that have come out around units that are at risk of being lost to conversion to market rate in transit corridors for seniors is really a very significant problem. The AARP just came out with a study documenting the potential number of units that will be lost. These are not new units. These are existing units. So I think in the short term, I think our focus really will be on preservation, acknowledging that that's a cost-effective way to not lose them. And if they're already near transit corridors and we can save them, then we feel like that's a really good investment scenario.
Madam Chair, the second one is one I'm just curious if anybody at the agency or elsewhere that you're aware of is looking at, and related to when you were talking about your interest rates and home ownership counseling and the fact that not everybody's appropriate for it and so on. I was curious about foreclosure victims, people who you might call very responsible homeowners who actually had an appropriately underwritten loan and they lost their job. And they lost their home and they're out in the cold and they've got terrible credit rating now and they have almost no chance of ever getting another loan again. Is there anybody talking about creative ways to look out, figure out if there's some people who are very appropriately homeowners who had reasonable loans and they were just out of work for a year and a half and lost their home? Is there anybody looking at ways to try and explore that either in Minnesota or elsewhere to find a way, if, since they already have the skills you need for homeownership, and they had a bad luck hit them for a year or two, and are they out for life, or is there anybody taking a look at whether there's a way to help with that?
Ms. Blankenberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, some nonprofits are trying a contract for deed model to figure out if that will be helpful to kind of get them in the door and get them making their payments so that they can improve their credit. It is pretty difficult, but they are looking at that here in the Twin Cities.
Madam Chair, I hope that is explored a little more because I think there are a lot of people who, again, it's the kind of thing we often do in society. They make one mistake or they have one misfortune in it, and they never have a chance to get back into it. And I don't know that that should overcome other urgent needs, but I think it's something that a lot of people, because of 1 year of loss of job, they're gone for good from homeownership. Then the bigger question I have, Madam Chair, is when the last several years, I guess this is the year we're supposed to have completed the long-term homelessness solution, and you're talking appropriately, as I see, because we don't have the funds for the services to go along with it, of extending that longer. I remember when the focus came to long-term homelessness that we were sort of taking money away from short-term homelessness projects and problems, and so I'm glad you're looking at returning to that. But the bigger picture, when Senator Dibble mentioned this $50 billion potential gap in the next decade between what MnDOT's revenues are and what the needs as they see them are, when will we, is there a end date in which we hope to address the homeless issue where we can say that Minnesotans are going to not be homeless? We're going to end long-term homelessness, which, again, when that was taken on 4, 5, 6 years ago, that was the hardest part of the problem to address, we felt, or I think people involved felt. But none of it's acceptable, I think you'd agree. And is there a timeline? Do you have a goal 10 years from now, 8 years from now, 20 years from now, where we would solve the issue?
Well, I could say that part of the emphasis on what we would talk about recalibrating or relooking at that will be, one, from my perspective, is to draw on what we've learned in the past 5 years about what works and what doesn't. And, you know, it was somewhat of a bold step forward, and I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from what we've done as a community around homelessness. Recognizing that long-term homelessness, many of the long-term homeless are really folks with mental illness or some barriers that are above and beyond what might be a normal, you know, situation. But that being said, that, you know, in this current time where you have additional homeless occurring, which is more short term, I think, it calls into question the relationship between prevention and long-term homeless, solving that problem through housing and services. And I think that the effort that we will take on in the next year to look at this issue will have to address the question of prevention and the kind of the more nuanced continuum of the long-term versus the short-term. We know that some of the people who are short-term become long-term. And so it's not as simple, I don't think it's as simple as just saying let's end long-term homelessness, but it's a part of a whole continuum. And I do think, though, that what's been done allows us to draw a lot of lessons learned that hopefully we can use to make our approach going forward even smarter. And that's what I would promise to you all, is that we'll make the best effort to harvest what we've learned, sort out what's practical, being more realistic about service dollars going forward, et cetera. But I don't think it's should be seen as a critique or a negative critique of what was done, because I think that we've gone a long way on the path towards addressing a real serious issue. I do think that the healthcare industry needs to be more engaged in the long-term homeless piece, because really most of those folks have mental illness, and it's a different set of issues. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Marty.
Commissioner, I wasn't meaning to criticize the long-term homeless thing. I do criticize the fact that the funding for it largely came out of ignoring more of the rest of the problem. But I think you're right. I like your attempt to try and recalibrate, I guess was your term, make sure we, with the recognition some of the short-term homeless do become long-term homeless. The reason I'm asking about the long and short-term homeless is because Senator Dibble and I were on the Poverty Commission, which had a title of Legislative Commission on Ending Poverty in Minnesota by 2020. And I don't think you can say when we have homeless, either short-term or long-term, that we've addressed the issue. And I'm glad I liked the thing that was best about the long-term homelessness was it was a deadline. We're going to try and do this, and we're not succeeding for reasons I think we both recognize. But I'm just wondering if anybody in the department is envisioning how we're going to and when we're going to try and address this. Our commission, the easy thing for people on the commission to do is say, well, you know, it's a nice goal, but we're not really serious about it. And I always thought that if we weren't serious about it, we should have renamed it instead of a commission on ending poverty by 2020, we should have renamed it the commission on making poverty a little less miserable for some of the people in it by 2020. And I wouldn't have wanted to serve on that commission. I don't think any legislators would have chosen to, because it's kind of saying we're admitting defeat. And so I guess I'm wondering, is there in the back of your mind or somebody's mind what we should be aiming for? Because I'm glad you're recalibrating. I think it's wise to recognize we're not going to have finished the one goal by 2010. But is there a goal in somebody's mind about how to do this?
Well, I think that is will be the primary purpose of this reflection period. This will take some time to bring people together to try to identify what is realistic. Reset a time frame, not to take away the goal, but to just reset the characteristics of the plan so that we can reach that at some point in a realistic way. And that's, you know, in this environment, it's really a challenge to move forward, and maybe even impossible at the pace that we were. Nevertheless, I think we've made some really good progress, and there is that opportunity to get there, but it's going to take a longer time frame. And the other thing I would say is that it's not something that Minnesota Housing can do on its own. And the reality is that it becomes a big part of the challenge for poverty or homelessness, is that it's not a singular dimensional thing. It requires action on the part of a variety of parties to think about the integration of these issues so you can get at it. And that's the complexity both of homelessness but also of poverty.
Madam Chair, just a final comment. I strongly agree with your last point. It's not a function of just the agency or just government, but it's nonprofits and government and business and everyone working together on it. But I just hope that the agency can help provide some of the vision in terms of not just for the long-term homeless, but for the entire issue.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal, I think you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Thank you, Senator Marty and Dibble. That's what we're all here for. We want to see homelessness. And I'm going to digress for just a moment, talk about a small piece, and that's the tax credits that Senator Kielash brought up. When we had discussions last session, tax credits were not being used. Their value was something like 50 to 60 cents on the dollar, down from 90 cents on the dollar previously. And you're talking about you can, the developer, if I understand it correctly, can now return them to the agency and you can get 80 cents on the dollar from the federal government?
The agency gets the 80 cents, and we get to choose what developer we work with after that. So it's not immediately guaranteed that it goes back to that particular developer.
Right.
That's just the way that works.
Okay, that's great. Where is the marketplace without that 80% coming back to you? Where is the tax credit marketplace currently? Is it 50 cents on the dollar? Is it 60 cents on the dollar? Has it changed since last session? Is it starting to go up, or is it just flat?
Mission?
I believe it's around just over 60 cents on a dollar. That's the last level that I heard about. We could get that for you, though, because we have people who are on top of that. We can certainly provide that to you.
Okay, that'd be great, because there doesn't seem to be much movement in that market. I'm wondering if you're seeing any kind of rebound, or do you foresee any rebound in the near future?
I think it's very early to see that. Most of the entities that were buying tax credits were banking institutions. And so one of the things we are doing right now is to try to help get exposure to other potential investors, meaning larger corporations and things, that might see it in their interest to purchase tax credits, both for their business, but also because it would help Minnesota. And we're in the process of, just went through a whole process working with some of the syndicators to sort that out, and some of the developers to think about how we might approach larger scale businesses together. And then we're going to move forward with that in the next couple of months to at least get some meetings with the leadership of some senior business leadership. But that's not a solution to the pricing.
Right.
But if you could get some investors in there, then you have at least a chance.
Okay. I want to leave some time for any comments from the public. Are there any more questions, though, that committee members want to have? Can I just make one comment? I was very interested when I read in your report that you sent us earlier that the agency is committed to exploring aids to those households that are having temporary decline in income, and I thought that Senator Marty's question was addressing that. But I don't hear a very energetic, addressing of it by the agency yet, and so I'm really wondering what you were thinking of when you wrote that paragraph, because I think you only talk about it in terms of mortgages through the MHFA, and I'm just wondering if you have some other ideas. I think we're hungry for those kind of ideas. We'd really like to work with you and whatever we need to might be bringing up with our banking sector or others to do that. Because Senator Marty, when you were talking about people losing a job, sometimes they're just losing one of two or three jobs, and that's what makes their house unaffordable. We have people working so hard right now to stay in their houses, and this foreclosure crisis is just—it's so significant to those of us who are, talking with our constituents. And I guess I just am looking for a little more, commitment maybe, or creative ideas that you could throw out, even if you think they're, a little far-fetched, that if we could somehow work together on something that would really, push us all, and not just you, push us all to try to address this. It's just so devastating to some parts of our communities. And so I'm just wondering when that was written, what you were thinking of beyond just MHFA back mortgages, or if you don't have an answer for that today, maybe we could talk about it later. But is there something you had in mind when you were referring to that?
Well, let's just say it's on the radar screen, and I think if Tanya was here, she might have something to share with you. I think she may have some ideas about what might be possible. I don't have them myself, but that was something we were going to, once we kind of got this in place and kept, we've had a lot going on as an agency, to be able to take a little time to think about what are some of these ideas, these broad stroke ideas mean, pen to pencil, you know, pen to paper or whatever. We haven't gotten there with these ideas yet.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the only thing that I would add is that I think often these situations are often these ideas, our solutions, are coming from various places. I talked to Senator Kelash a lot about the stuff that you guys do in cities and counties. And so I think one of the things, at least that will help me, and I think the committee, is that if we can develop a communication strategy that will help us talk to our constituents as well as help you with whatever ideas you have about what are those ideas and opportunities. For instance, I spoke about the land bank today. That was just something that a constituent that happened to work for a housing nonprofit mentioned to me in an oh by the way conversation that ultimately is a pretty well developed and hopefully successful strategy at trying to stabilize neighborhoods. And so I think as we move forward, if we can really continue to work with your staff in establishing what ideas we may have and then also the things that are emerging, I think that really helps us, because often I know I got caught flat-footed, and as I talked to some of my other committee members, they weren't aware of the strategy as well.
Okay. Well, any other comments, questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. Just hang around, because we'll see if there's any public comment. Any members of the audience who'd like to make some reflections on the plan as it has been proposed, please come forward, and we'll be glad to give you a seat. I see Mr. Halbeck standing up. Are there others? How many people, let me just see a raising of hands, how many people would like to address the committee and share your thoughts about this today? Okay, two people I see. Okay, great. Mr. Halbeck, are you coming down? I think I thought I saw you. Who's the other person right there? Okay. Oh, great. We have a team approach. That's great. Welcome.
Can't do this alone.
Welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you. I'm Chip Halbach, the director of Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I'm joined here by Michael Dahl.
We're the public policy director with HomeLine, a low-income tenants organization.
Welcome, both of you.
And I don't want to, so thank you, Madam Chair, go into a lot of program by program, but I just do appreciate the opportunity to make a few points about the agency's affordable housing plan, but probably more important about the occasion of this hearing. I've been tracking the work of the Minnesota Housing at the legislature for over 20 years or so, and I can't remember a time where the agency came in and had this dialogue with legislators about the planning document of the agency before its adoption. So I think it's a credit to Representative Clark and Senator Kelash and the rest of you for making the time to come and have this discussion with the agency. As we all know, this is a critical time in our country's history, our state's history, in terms of working our way through the recession and the housing consequence of the recession. And so it's very important at any time, but particularly now, build the communication that was spoken of and mutual trust as we try to work together and figure out what the appropriate state role is in this immense problem of people finding and maintaining affordable places to live. I also appreciate Commissioner Bartholomew and the work of the agency with this affordable housing plan. There are questions that have come up about, you know, what's new and what is the agency working on. Whether there's a lot of innovation in the plan itself. There's, as was spoken of, there's the effort to support the land bank, as Representative Hayden mentioned. There's a continuing and stronger commitment about the stewardship of the housing, ensuring that the housing works for individual families and communities for decades, and the green housing and environmentally safe and sound housing. All of that is an innovation going on at the State Housing Agency and other agencies across the state. Also in the plan is effort of the Minnesota Housing to support this, the work being done now to preserve the homes of people who are in manufactured housing and manufactured home parks. They're very much at risk of the closing of those parks and the loss of their homes. The agency's plan includes some millions of dollars to, in loan money to help facilitate the ongoing cooperative ownership of those parks to secure ownership by the residents. And also in terms of the effort to look more broadly at the homelessness and think harder at this point in time about the episodic or the short-term homelessness that's occurring now. I just think that the agency should be commended for these strides that are taken and the work that it is serving the state with. I am concerned in, you know, several areas about what's happening or what isn't happening. You can only do so much, I realize that. But one was raised earlier by Senator Marty about the seniors. You know, I have a report here that was prepared 5 years ago by Minnesota Housing, lay out some policy options to help get on top of this problem with ever-growing numbers of low-income seniors who are at risk of losing their housing, and we haven't gotten there yet. And Commissioner Bartholomew mentioned one report that speaks to the need of preserving senior housing. Also, I would point out that in the Wilder Research produced a report for the East Metro area identifying for the decade starting in 2010, you know, a few months around the corner, that of the some 14,000 new affordable housing units needed in the metro area, 10,000 of those are needed by low-income seniors. This is a significant problem that as there's some brain space at the agency, we need to begin to think through what are the appropriate strategies for getting on top of that. The other area that I believe that more work is needed is in the area of all of these smaller communities in rural Minnesota, particularly the county seats that don't have the concentrations of foreclosures but do have critical housing needs that right now less attention is being paid to because there's the big problem elsewhere. And so I do have encouraged the agency, and I think it's something to come back to, or what's happening in rural Minnesota. And, you know, while resources are going to greater Minnesota, a lot of that's going to the regional centers in greater Minnesota, but there's a ton of county seats out there that aren't able to access resources for housing. Those, in my mind, are important points, but they're smaller points in the overall work that's proposed by the agency, which, again, I commend. Senator Devil earlier in the session was asking about, well, what's the big picture, and how do we get a sense of our commitment of $20 million or $30 million. What does that mean in the greater scheme of things? And he raised about what was called the BBC report, which said in this decade that will end in a year that there is 33,000 units of homes, 33,000 affordable homes that are needed. Well, which is the finding of that report, a report that was created in part by Minnesota Housing to get a handle on that big picture. Those 33,000 units are needed in addition to what at that point, 2003, was the production rate that was going on. Well, since 2003 in that report, the production of affordable housing hasn't gone up at all by any meaningful amount. So we're still sitting here with that big problem. One thing our agency did was to monetize that, to figure out, well, what does that mean dollar-wise? And it's a big price tag. It was approximately $500 million per year in additional gap money is needed. So we have a significant issue before us in terms of how people across the state can be affordably housed. The agency is doing a great job, but it was going to require the agency and legislature and the private sector figuring out how we get through this recession and do the best we can to get on top of that problem. But part of it is understanding what the problem is, and I think that was Senator Dibble's point. So I concur with that, and we all need to do a better job of just understanding the magnitude of what's needed out there for housing. I'll conclude my part in just saying that tomorrow the housing data or the housing component of the American Community Survey will be released. And I believe that's going to show that in Minnesota still remains, 1 in 8 households across the state is paying over half their income for housing. 1 in 8. And in this recession, the looks like foreclosures are going to continue at a rapid pace. Homelessness, the use of shelters is continuing at a rapid pace. We need to have this dialogue. To Representative Hayden, you ask about foreclosures. Well, what we look at is defaults, how many people are 60 days behind, because that says something about the foreclosures possibly to come. Currently, for both the agency's mortgages and mortgages across the state, 6% of households with mortgages are 60 days or more behind. 6%. That's up from about 2% just 3 or 4 years ago. So there are a lot more households at risk here, and we need this dialogue which took place here today with the agency and the legislature. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Mr. Dell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to try to answer the question that Senator Dibble asked about what's the scale and how do you figure out how big the problem is that you need to solve. And I'm going to steal a lot of numbers from this guy over here because I'm stealing it from him. to try to give a sense of where we are right now and what we'd hope the state could do to help make the situation better. A couple of the things actually are not things that Minnesota Housing has any charge of, but I still think it's important to bring them up. First, as a working for an organization that helps tenants stay in their housing or maintain their housing, we need to do all that we can to make sure the rental market is one where tenants have a fair shot of finding and maintaining housing and sort of a level playing field as they're trying to find an affordable and quality place to live. And there are different things in tenant landlord law that can be done to make that as good of a process as possible when they're searching for an apartment unit. Secondly, the legislature fought an attempt to cut the renter's credit last session and did so. And Governor Pawlenty then unallotted the renter's credit by 27%. I just want to point out that $51 million that was taken away from the renter's credit for 1 year is more than the Housing Finance Agency received from the state. That was money that people were using to pay for their own bills. And so when you're talking about the scale of things, this was money that wasn't going to a state agency, but to low-income people to afford whatever it is they needed to afford. Now, as far as the scale of things that the Housing Partnership, that Minnesota Housing and state government, federal government are all trying to solve, and so I'm not saying they're anybody's one problem to solve, but what we all need to take a look at is that about half of all renters are paying more than half of their income for housing, or more than a third of their income for housing, and a quarter are paying over half. That's 230,000 households that are paying over 30% of their income for housing, and by the federal definition, that's unaffordable. There's other demands that they can't meet when they're paying for that resource. So that's the scale of the problem for them. If we're trying to look at what it costs to actually keep the housing that some people are living in as housing that they can keep living in, and we take a look at public housing that state and federal government has put resources into, there's a backlog of $400 to $500 million worth of repairs that need to happen, and some of this housing is at risk, and you'll find in a report produced by the Minnesota Housing Partnership, public housing at risk, that talks about these needs. Now, the bonding proposal that I think the commissioner made note of put some effort at dealing with this problem, as were the recovery dollars from this past year. But we have a huge problem in the number of units that are in need of repairs and could be lost in the future. I think lastly, just to point out that the questions were asked about the short-term homeless, long-term homeless, people who are falling into foreclosure right now, and there's going to be someone who's going to say that, you know, this year we can't do more because the state's in a tough situation. And I see you nodding there, Senator Kielash, but to realize that when we don't, it's the individuals and the communities, the problem doesn't disappear. It's just who's paying for it. And what you have are the most vulnerable populations falling into more vulnerable situations, whether or not it's low-income renters, short-term homeless, or long-term homeless. The problem won't go away. It's just a matter of the ability of is that years down the road, we're going to have a much more significant problem to address that's going to be much more costly. And so to find ways to address this problem in a very focused manner, and then lastly, and I'll put my comments, is that it's true that poverty and housing and homelessness are very complex, and you can't say Minnesota housing has to solve the problem or human services. But you can make investments in critical areas that don't make a housing problem become a human service problem. And that, many of us would say, is actually what happens with a lot of homelessness, is that there are people that have mental illnesses and housing, and then they have mental illnesses and they don't have housing. And then they have abuse and no housing. And it just spirals down. And it's a question for the state, what type of problem do you want to resolve, I guess? Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from committee members? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, for Mr. Halbach, you mentioned something I was just curious a little more about. You had mentioned the department's working with manufactured housing, trying to help. I didn't ask the commissioner who would have been the appropriate one, but could you just give a little more information, because I wasn't aware of that, and I'm glad to hear it.
Well, it probably didn't have the commissioner come back up, but thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Marty. I do have some knowledge of it because it's being carried. The work is being led by the North Country Cooperative Foundation, which works with cooperative housing development, and here specifically manufactured home parks, and a national effort under the name of ROC USA, for resident-owned communities, which has realized that looking at home ownership, the very most affordable home ownership that exists in this country has been in manufactured housing, and there's some 50,000 of those homes and parks here in Minnesota alone. But In nearly every situation, the parks are at risk from closure, and sometimes it's related to just the changing economy. Other times it's related to a new road coming through. But the effort of this ROC USA and the North Country Cooperative Foundation is to provide financing and support for residents of these parks throughout the state to help them acquire their park and set up a cooperative to ensure ongoing utility of that housing. And the agency is, through its plan, it intends to be an investor in that effort. And that's about as far as I can go.
Commissioner, would you want to address that? Why don't you come on up to the microphone, please? Thank you.
We have been looking for a way to support, in principle, what resident-owned cooperative USA has been trying to do. And now they've figured out a way that we can provide an investment-grade support and get a return on it and support the ability for these cooperatives to form, basically save these parks and create the possibility that they would get more value out of their homes, ultimately, in terms of market value and also greater stability. And as Chip said, there's about 50,000 units in the state. And I think that these projects will likely be working with parks that are not in the worst of conditions because there are often infrastructure kinds of issues and things that make it difficult, but at least begin the process of being able to show the model that you can actually create ownership opportunities where the manufactured home owner then ends up owning his land or her land. And that creates all kinds of additional benefits for them in terms of the potential to get different kind of mortgage products and things like that. So we're committed to trying to support that effort here as one of maybe five national models, I think, where there's some other states that may do some similar things, but we're committed to that.
Great. Any other questions or comments?
Well,
Senator Kinesh.
I'm not sure if I should address this to Chip or the Commissioner. One of the things that keeps coming up here is the increase in the need for affordable housing, which some of that seems to be with the stagnant wages and housing increasing. We've got an issue where essentially the taxpayers of Minnesota are having to subsidize people that aren't making enough at their jobs in order to pay for basic housing needs. And I'm not sure exactly how you solve that in this committee, but it certainly looks like it's, you know, in a time when we're looking at huge deficits in the state budget coming forward, and, you know, Chip's saying I need $100 million, or Michael is saying that, whatever that case may be, it's, we have to solve that wage problem somehow as well so that we have stopped the increase in the number of folks needing affordable housing at taxpayers' expense. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do that, and we certainly won't do it in this committee. But the other thing, I've been, you know, as the one of the newest members of these committees, I've been concerned that it seems like there's lots of pots of money in all the different state agencies, some coming from the Fed, some coming from the state. In you know, we have housing out of the Veterans Committee, and Deeds got some housing money, and you can go on and on. And I'm just wondering if there's any value in trying to put all those numbers in some kind of order and who's administrating it, and so that personally, I don't think I've got an understanding of this. The agency is great with the financing part of it, but then there's the Health and Human Services that needs supportive housing. There's the vets have something, ag's got something. It's really all over. And so if you could just respond to, you know, is this something that we can actually attempt to try to save administrative dollars or do more with less?
Well, I would comment on, number one, I think your point about Minnesota housing not being the sole source of financing for housing in the state is absolutely true. And trying to get a better picture of what all the resources going into housing are from various points is a really smart idea, and I think something that we would like to do or figure out ourselves, just because then you have a little bit more information to work with. That being said, I think the question there's always need for more money because of the volume of the problem. On the other hand, if you think about it from the standpoint of how we spend the money that we have, And that's where I think, you know, as an agency, we would like to try to get the maximum impact out of our housing investments by making sure it's near transit opportunities. You know, we know people are having trouble paying for housing, but if they have to have two cars and pay for housing, they're that much worse shape. Those two things combined are the largest single cost to a household, transportation and housing. And we have situations where people can't find housing near where they work, and that's partly based on the financing, but partly based on zoning and other things, mm-hmm. land use and other things. So some of the work that we do dovetails in that the expenses associated with some of the products we invest in. Some of that accrues to the challenge of getting things sited in communities, locating things near employment centers and near transit. And I think from the standpoint of doing more with what we have or more with less, I think we'd like to just focus on more with what we have, that we can do a better job of that by aligning those investments, whether it's transit, housing, livability issues, things of that nature. We can do a better job as a state of lining that stuff up.
Thank you.
Representative Saylor, and then Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you just referenced the difficulty that people have with transportation, you know, if they're having trouble with, you know, making their payments and then getting to work, especially in rural areas. But in any case, I'm just wondering if there's a third piece in this and that you're maybe looking at with Department of Health, for instance, or other areas, and that is child care. Because what I hear from people is that they have trouble meeting the child care need, and if they can get to work, that's one thing, but then child care is over here, work is over here, their house is here. I'm just wondering how you're partnering with any other organizations on that aspect as well, and if you hear that is a problem or not. Maybe I'm just hearing that, but I just was curious about that extent. Thank you.
In general, that's obviously one of the biggest challenges for families is what do you do with your kids? And certainly some of our nonprofit partners do create facilities that provide child care on site. That tends to be more in the nonprofit realm than it is in the for-profit realm in terms of service provision. That is one way of solving it. The other side of the coin, though, is, and in some cases, you know, there are employers who do, you know, have on-site daycare as well. That is one of those things that I think is a win-win if it's understood well for employers, employees, and communities, if you can think about that. But that is a little bit out of the realm of what we do, but it's not out of the realm of what we need to think about in terms of how you site and locate housing, transportation, other things near community amenities. But it's not something that we deal with directly in our project. But we do look at those kinds of things in terms of where housing is located relative to amenities and services in our choices we make and which projects we finance. So we do have a number of criteria around livability, green, location, transit orientation, that projects that are located well will be more likely to get our funding than projects that aren't located well. So we do have some of that provision in there.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, because I do understand that there are some businesses that have been assisting with child care and helping there to be a location for it, that sort of a thing. And as these businesses are being stressed out more, they're finding that they're going to have to back off on some of these other forms of assistance, such as child care, and that's making, of course, a big difference. And I recognize that that's not your main focus, but I would hope that as you're looking at that as a piece of, you know, this whole part that we're working on, that you can, you know, continually bring that forward if there's some way that we can work together or help other agencies work on that piece, because as I understand it, that's going to make a big difference in some areas in particular.
Makes sense.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you touched on it briefly. We haven't talked about it a lot, but that's the regulatory issues as to getting more affordable housing, or and I'm just wondering if there's been much done along that line. I was talking to a contractor the other day who went and got a permit in St. Paul, and the permit cost more than the repair, and it was it was like $1,600 for the permit and $400 for the plumbing repair. And so I'm wondering if we're looking at the regulatory issues surrounding maintaining and improving, you know, residential property so that it, you know, it can come back into service and, you know, REO properties or properties that need or are renovated and those types of things. That seems to be a big opportunity in my mind for additional housing. Has there been any work or studies done in that area at all?
Commissioner?
I'm not aware of them in particular around the kind of issues you're talking about in terms of the regulatory environment, but I'm sure there are some more broadly. You know, there are institutions that have looked at things like that, but I don't have any in my mind anyway.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, we have another member from the audience who would like to comment. And are there any others? Okay, then after this witness, I think we'll probably be able to conclude our testimony. Welcome to the committee if you introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I am Jean Lee, and today I represent an organization called Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, which is a collaborative of over 15 Asian Pacific organizations, and we're growing because we're trying to break through some of the barriers that are present as far as Asian organizations being able to access information and funds and being able to serve the community. There are great needs in the community. There's over 200,000 Asian Pacific Islanders, many of whom are not being served. They're not culturally being served. So when they come to the agencies who lack the funds, they can't get the appropriate types of help. Now, one of the things that I wanted, so I look forward as far as to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and all their programs as far as involving us in that so we can address the needs of the community. The second issue was that the HECAT was mentioned. When it went through last session as far as funding for counselors and funding for some of the different areas, we thought that that would be great, would be able to serve our communities. We found out that some of the funding was already pre-designated, so as soon as it came, it went out to other agencies. And then the process as far as our agencies being able to apply for the funds, there were a lot of barriers to that. So I don't believe, well, I know a large group has not gotten the funding. So, again, we're not able to serve the communities. The legislative law says that counselors have to be certified and that they have to take courses for certification. There are four groups that are listed. In this, two of them are not in Minnesota. One is Neighborhood Works, America, AARP, Reverse Mortgage is another one. Another one in Minnesota is called the Minnesota Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Association. We understood that, and the fourth one is Home Ownership Center. We understood that the Home Ownership Center told Minnesota Mortgage Foreclosure Association not to teach any more of their classes. So this was an avenue for our Asian organizations to have housing counselors being trained, and that is no longer open to us. And as of October 1st, we understand that Minnesota Housing came up with a new criteria saying that even if you had Neighborhood Works America training, you still must have home ownership courses, and that comes along once a year and is only available to those receiving the funds through Minnesota Housing. So again, the Asian organizations are being left out. We have about over 20 people who have to travel out of state for training for the Neighborhood Works, all over from California to Washington, D.C. to Arizona, when by law it should be available here in Minnesota. So we're looking for options and avenues to break through the barriers. We also are being excluded as far as access to information. And so we aren't able to, as far as the Asian organizations, get the people properly informed to be able to help the agencies in a culturally appropriate way. So many of these people are still going to be in your numbers as far as people aren't being served, underserved, people facing foreclosure and so forth. So I wanted to bring that to your attention so that we might be able to work on a solution in this upcoming session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Ms. Lee? Okay. Thank you very much. And committee members, thank you for... I guess I'm allowed to have my committee approve the minutes from our previous hearing. If the senators will just bear with us briefly, I'll do that. It's a meeting from three meetings, is that right? Wednesday, April 15th, and May 13th, May 11th and May 14th. Is there any discussion on those minutes? Committee members, you did have them in your packet. Representative McNamara?
I can move those minutes. You want to do them both at one time?
Let's just do all three.
That'd be fine. I'll move them both.
Okay, Representative McNamara moves the approval of those three committee minutes. All those in favor on the right hand. Oh, let's see. And Representative Saylor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The House prevails in this case. and I want to thank the senators, especially Senator Kulash and all of those of you who made time to come today. Really appreciate it. I think, Commissioner, I just want to thank you very much for making this available. I think it was the beginning of a very good discussion, and we do have our work laid out for us with the next session, and this is a good blueprint for us to work from. Thank you very much. With that, committee members, the meeting is going to be adjourned in 1 second, but please hand in your per diem slips if you do for us, and I guess you'll probably deal with those on that side.
Yes.
Okay. Meeting is adjourned.